And welcome back to Midday Election Day. Dan Rodrigues here. Thanks again for joining us. Yes, primary election day in Maryland, and registered Democrats and Republicans are heading to the polls, though apparently not in large numbers, to select their party's candidates, most prominently for governor. Independent voters, though, are left out of the process. Only registered Democrats and Republicans get to determine who will be competing in Maryland's general election in November. A recent Pew study indicated that voters are more likely than ever to vote consistently along party lines in this year's general election. Well, despite all that, our guest this hour believes that there could be a disruption to entrenched party line politics in which the left and the right, libertarians, progressives, find common ground to pose a challenge to big business and their allies in Congress. Ralph Nader, a longtime consumer rights advocate and political activist, has a new book laying out this theory. It's called Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. He breaks it all down, breaks down the current climate that we're in, this climate of political polarization, how it came to be, and how it could change. Ralph Nader says the corporate class manufactured the current system, the dominant two-party political system, because big business realized how profitable such polarization can be. You know, think about it. As bickering and uncooperative politics distracts people from realizing that they often have the same goals of a strong competitive economy as well as a safe and healthy environment. Ralph Nader has been working to protect citizens from the interests of large corporations and government corruption since the 1960s, and he gets to join us here on Election Day to talk about this theory, of this idea of a libertarian-progressive alliance and how such an alliance can be achieved. And if you have a question for Ralph Nader in this hour, I've always wanted to talk to him and pose a question along these lines, please give us a ring. Ralph Nader, welcome back to Midday. It's nice to get to talk to you again.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Hey, you know, I was thinking so much about what you're writing about in this book, about the idea of common ground, and I want to give you my example of this. When, at the Baltimore Sun a few years ago, I started writing about the subject of ex-offenders, people coming out of prison, mostly men, who had no way to find a job, whose criminal record was being held against them. They couldn't find work. So you had this repeated cycle of people who had been convicted of crimes, doing their time, coming out of prison, unable to find work, falling back into the same trap and going back into prison. And Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, libertarians, anybody, just name the political stripe. They all said to me, you know, that's a problem. That doesn't make sense. We've got to do something about this, because if you've done the crime and you've paid the time, you should get a break when you come out. We should find a way to help these people find jobs. So that's my own personal experience, where I got equal amount of email from liberals, conservatives, people in the middle, who said that's a problem. We need to do something about it. And I think that's the kind of common ground issue you're talking about.
Yeah, I have 24 examples in the book Unstoppable where there is already a left-right alliance in terms of public opinion out there around the country, and that represents tens of millions of voters. And the example that you alluded to, Dan, can be elaborated, because a few years ago, right-wingers Grover Norquist and others, Newt Gingrich, started a group called Right on Crime. And what was the purpose? The purpose was to stop these huge multi-year sentences that are filling the jails and making the prison industrial complex and the private jail industry profitable. Long sentences for nonviolent crimes, for example, just having a few ounces of marijuana or whatever. And so they're coming at it from the right wing, saying this is a huge waste of taxpayer dollars. Billions of dollars are being wasted incarcerating people who shouldn't be incarcerated for that period of time. On the other side, you have the civil liberties groups, the liberals and progressives, who think this is just what you said. It's a self-destructive situation where they come out and they've been there for a long time and they don't have skills and they're blacklisted. They can't get a job. In some states, they can't vote, ex-felons. So, and it's a human rights issue for progressives and liberals. So that's why in about 15 state legislatures already, you have juvenile justice reform of some of these long sentences. And Donald Ross, who's heading this drive, told me now a while back that these laws would never have been passed without right-left legislators coming together in one state after another.
And you say you have 24 examples in your book, Unstoppable, and I want to hear about those, Ralph, as we go along through this hour. But you have to answer this question for me at the beginning here, because most of the time our conversation is about how polarized the country is.
Yeah.
You know, how distant we are, Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, and there's all this bickering and arguing that goes on in a Congress that can get nothing done.
Well, you see, that's what, for hundreds of years, the rulers of society have had a divide and rule strategy. So there's nothing new. And so while there are real differences between left and right, for example, they differ on gun control, they differ on school prayer, they differ on balanced budgets, they differ on a number of issues, and there's no point denying it. But why is it that's all we hear about? All we hear about, whether it's right, left, whether it's blue state, red state, whether it's Republican, Democrat in Congress, all we hear about are the areas of disagreement. That's where the press focuses, television, radio, that's where the newspapers focus. In the meantime, what is completely ignored, although it's bubbling up now, and I'll give some examples, are the left-right agreements, where they agree, where they converge on areas of very, very significant importance. You might have remembered that Congressman Ron Paul in 2010 teamed up with Congressman Barney Frank, Republican Libertarian with Paul, a liberal Democrat with Frank, to start an entity, and they actually staffed it in the House of Representatives to challenge the bloated military budget and derivatively the whole empire of wars of choice and bases in 120 countries, the American empire. So that you're seeing that happen now in the minimum wage. When the minimum wage restoration, which would take it to, you know, between $10 and $11 an hour from the $7.25 federal minimum wage, mm-hmm. when that was pulled, Dan, it comes in between 70% and 80%. And you can't get 70% and 80% of the American people behind something like that without a lot of conservatives and liberals, voters, answering the poll questions that way. And for 30 million workers who now make, get this, they make less today than workers made in 1968 adjusted for inflation. That is, they're making between 7.25, you know, Walmart-type workers, and say $10.80 or $10.90, which is what it would be if the 1968 minimum wage was adjusted for inflation. So this is a big deal. And now you have Mitt Romney coming out for a restored minimum wage. You have Rick Santorum. You have former Republican governor of Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty. You have Phyllis Schlafly, a conservative advocate of many years, coming out for it. The only people who don't get the message are the Republican leaders in the House and Senate. But they're getting the heat all right, and a lot of cities and towns are not waiting. A lot of states are raising minimum wages at least by a dollar or so without waiting for Washington. But you see, that victory, and I believe it's coming, is going to come because of a left-right public opinion support of it.
It's very interesting. Ralph, you say in the book that the Republican Party has a double life, or a double identity, sort of a body double. The main party is dominated by corporatists, the word corporatists, and the adjunct party relying on conservatives and libertarians to produce the margin of votes for victory in elections. Can you talk about this split in the Republican Party?
Right. It's becoming more pronounced because the Tea Party is basically representing more of the libertarian wing. The Republican corporatists, you know, corporatism basically is the doctrine that big corporations are best managing our economy. And big corporations know best what government should be doing. So to sum up the opposing view, which is increasingly becoming active, you know, challenging Republicans. These are the people that defeated Eric Cantor a while back in his primary fight in Virginia. And it was done by a libertarian professor of economics at Randolph-Macon College, and his argument was against crony capitalism. Now, the right wing calls corporate welfare crony capitalism, and liberals call corporate subsidies, handouts, giveaways, bailouts. They call that corporate welfare. But in the book, I quote Ed Crane, who is one of the founders of the Cato Libertarian Institute think tank in Washington, D.C., and he said to me, "Ralph, I oppose all corporate subsidies, unconstitutional wars, liberty restricting the Patriot Act, and the Federal Reserve run amok." And I said to him, you know, that's a pretty good start for left-right alliance.
Right.
And that's where it is. So you have the Republican Party now is increasingly besieged by the people who don't like crony capitalism, and they elaborate it. They don't like football stadiums and baseball stadiums funded by taxpayers, for example. They don't like mismanaged corporations going to Washington for taxpayer bailouts the way the Wall Streeters did in the crash of 2008 and 2009 that cost 8 million jobs throughout the United States. So I think this is going to be a troubling split in the coming elections. It's already driving the establishment Republicans crazy in primaries, and so the funders are wondering what they're going to do here. The bad aspect of it, it's going to give the Democrats more of a free ride. They think, well, the Republicans may split, and we're going to ride to victory. We don't have to. The corporate Democrats I'm speaking of, we don't have to adopt progressive policies because we're going to win. At the same time, we're dialing for the same corporate dollars that the Republicans are for our campaigns. So it's all this book is for readers, thinkers, and people who are serious about the future of our country. And it's a very short book by my standards, Dan.
It is.
And it's readable, and it goes into the history, and it's very specific, and it doesn't sugarcoat the problems of left-right alliances. It addresses them one after the other and shows how we can all overcome them for a better country. I mean, one thing most people are looking for is getting things done that are long overdue for the American people.
Ralph Nader is our guest on Midday here on WYPR. You're invited to call with a comment or question for Ralph Nader, 410-662-8780, toll-free long-distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. You can also send a question or comment by email, midday@wypr.org. We're on Twitter at @midday@WYPR. Ralph Nader, his latest book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Imagine that. Give us a ring if you have a question for Ralph. And welcome back. Dan Rodrigues here on Midday. Our guest is a longtime consumer advocate and political activist and candidate for president, Ralph Nader. His new book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State, explains his view on the current political climate, polarized American climate, and what we can do to end that, end the polarization, and get maybe an alliance of the left and the right to challenge the big business and its co-opted allies in Washington. Back with Ralph Nader. I want you to do one thing for me, Ralph Nader, is unpack Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act in the context of this discussion. Because for the last 4 years, you know, ever since, even before the act was passed in Congress, we had Tea Party demonstrators, conservative groups demonstrating, protesting against Obamacare, challenging it all the way to the Supreme Court. Efforts by Republicans in Congress continue to repeal it. And the question a lot of us had during all of that was, well, a couple of questions. One is, why are people opposed to something that could be in their own best interest? Because I assume not everybody in the Tea Party has insurance or health insurance, or maybe they did. Or I would assume that their health insurance might not have been as affordable as it could be potentially conceivably under the act. And the second issue was, you know, why would, what's their substitute? I mean, if they didn't have a, if there was no health insurance for 50 million Americans, what makes them, what do they have to offer it, or don't they think that's important? So a couple of different issues there, but I'd like you to unpack it for me.
Yeah. The opposition to Obamacare came from two sources. One is the right wing, and the Tea Party was very vociferous on that, including their representatives in Congress. And it must be added that, you know, if you took the 300,000 members of the Tea Party movement that the Washington Post estimated about a year after it started, there aren't many of those people that are poor, let's face it. I mean, a lot of them are independently employed. They're small business. They're professionals. They're not opposed to Obamacare because they want health insurance in a better frame. The other side comes from the progressives who oppose Obamacare because it's not universal health care. It's not full Medicare for all, everybody in, nobody out, free choice of doctor and hospital, and the giant insurance companies are replaced. That's what single-payer means, is that Medicare was single-payer for elderly people with a few gaps when it started back in the 60s. But single-payer means that the government is the health insurer and the delivery of health care comes privately from doctors and hospitals and so forth. And that's why when the polls showed a plurality or a majority against Obamacare, the press didn't point out that a significant slice of that opposition comes from people who want full Medicare for all. Indeed, since Harry Truman, a majority of the American people wanted full Medicare for all, and still do. But single-payer, full Medicare for all is not on the table of either party. Therefore, it's not discussed, it's mm-hmm. not polled very often, and it's not reported on.
Obama said that idea was dead on arrival.
Because he made it that way. He said he was for full Medicare for all. He was for single-payer. But it wasn't practical. What is not practical? It means he wasn't willing to mobilize the country when he was really high in the polls against the insurance companies that are never very popular and against the hospital chains who opposed it. Actually, a majority of doctors support full Medicare for all. The latest poll I saw, which was just a few years ago, 59% of the doctors came in that way. And one reason is they want to practice medicine. They don't want to practice bookkeeping all the complexities of the present system and the billing practices and so forth.
Well, let me challenge you on this, Ralph.
Yeah.
I can hear a libertarian saying, every man for himself. I don't want to be paying for somebody else's health insurance, subsidizing their health insurance. The government has no place in helping to provide health insurance for people. Is that not a libertarian line?
That's true. That's why when it comes to single payer, I don't have that in my 24 examples.
Okay.
However, it's not uniform, though. There are a lot of people who are not hardcore libertarians, but they're conservatives, mm-hmm. and they do want single payer. I mean, after all, the Mr. Conservative in the 1950s, Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, I mean, he was for unemployment compensation. That's government insurance. He was for public housing. He opposed wars of aggression overseas, empire. So you do have to distinguish, and I do that in the book. There are all kinds of categories. There's extreme libertarians, who don't want stop signs almost.
Right.
there are libertarians, there are conservatives, there are corporatists masquerading as conservatives. Those are usually in very powerful positions in government and big business. And the same for liberals. You know, there are liberal Democrats, there are corporate liberals, there are progressives. But I do clarify these matters, and it doesn't seem as confusing when you read this book. You will see that very powerful majorities, like it comes in 90% to break up the big New York banks, that are too big to fail. That comes in about 90%. Mm-hmm. The opposition to government exercising eminent domain, taking your house, like in New London, an actual Supreme Court case, taking your houses in a neighborhood, having them demolished and giving the land to Pfizer Corporation, which eventually walked away from it, by the way. That comes in 90% are against that eminent domain power. Of the government. Managed corporate trade, otherwise known as NAFTA, the World Trade Organization. There is a left-right alliance in the House of Representatives defying their own leadership, Speaker Boehner and Minority Leader Pelosi. And when the Trans-Pacific trade agreement, if it ever is solidified and is sent to the Congress for approval by President Obama, we now count, Dan, a majority of the House of Representatives, a small majority of the House of Representatives going to block fast-track procedure to ram it through. That could only happen with a left-right coalition. So, and for people who are listening and are a bit despairing of our country, its present situation and its future, I really urge you to read this book and start discussion groups in your living room or in your church basement or in auditoriums, because you will discover what I'm pointing out by yourself. You will discover in your own community a remarkable left-right alliance on very fundamental issues against government secrecy, for example, the NSA snooping, dragnet snooping of Americans, right out there, left-right alliance. It's also emerging in Congress in that manner, too.
A very close vote on a big piece of legislation regarding the NSA in Congress. It was pretty close.
Yeah, just missed by a few votes and in defiance of the leadership.
Yeah.
So you're getting a rebellion here. Where left-right are discovering one another and meeting and planning voting strategies.
Ralph, let's take a phone call here. Ralph Nader is our guest on Midday. Jay in Baltimore had a comment right along these lines. So thanks for calling, Jay.
Oh, hey, thank you very much. And Mr. Nader, thank you. Always appreciate your good work. And I just wanted to just say a very important facet of what you're talking about, a left-right coalition, especially with the left and libertarians. Is that you also, each side, in the process of working together, the other side becomes humanized. I used to be a professional libertarian, if you want to call it that. I actually worked for the Libertarian Party. And when you're an ideologue, as I once was, you know, and you have a very strong belief, there is a tendency to demonize the opposition. And you see this all the time, to ridiculous proportions. Well, then the first Persian Gulf War came along, just as an example, and I began working at a university with a progressive liberals who were opposed to the war, and it was a great experience. You know, we got along great, and we went out socially as well as working on demonstrations and things like this. And I'm just saying, over time, I'm not saying this is going to happen to everybody, but over time, that's what really cracked a lot of my old ideologue, you know, positions. And today, I'm basically pretty much a progressive liberal.
Let's hear from Ralph on that, Jay. Thanks for your comments.
That's an extraordinarily important insight. I can't emphasize that enough. Thank you for making it, because that is exactly what happens when these coalitions come together for victory. And I point out examples in the past where left-right coalitions got very important legislation through, the False Claims Act and the Whistleblower Act, to protect federal employees who blow the whistle on corporate fraud on the government. That couldn't have happened without left-right. And you could see it happen in Congress, where they wouldn't talk to one another, but when they started working one another, they started seeing, as the caller said, the humanity in each other. I mean, ideologies have some pluses because they're very motivating and they're very organizing. Their minuses is that they close minds and they stereotype opponents. And in so doing, they distance themselves from reality. And what left-right coalitions do is, when they're working, they connect with reality. The glue that is the glue between left-right alliances are the reality, and the reality cannot be shoved aside. As Aldous Huxley once said many years ago, facts do not cease to exist because they're ignored. And what abstract manipulation of people ideologically from both sides by the ruling powers exploit is the separation from reality, where they get people fighting over general ideologies that are unrooted from reality because they're designed to be controlling processes.
You know, Ralph, I want to challenge you a couple of things here. I mean, I like what you're saying, and I think there's a lot to it, and these 24 examples in your book are pretty convincing. But when it comes to Wall Street, for instance, you know, you can cite a poll that shows that most people, Republicans, Democrats, conservative, liberals, libertarians, all say, yeah, not enough was done in terms of prosecution of those responsible for the financial catastrophe that led to the Great Recession. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are opposed to the idea of a corporation being a bank being too big to fail and the government bailing them out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of solidarity on that. But when it comes to further regulating banks, for instance, or regulating business in any way, commerce, wouldn't the libertarians have a hard time with those coming from the left on that?
Not in this area, because libertarians do not like corporate coercion any more than they like government coercion. And while they do need education about what the corporate state means, that is the merger of Wall Street with Washington, to take two symbols, that's what corporate state means, where the influence of big business begins to take over government, and it leads to the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned about. It leads to huge tens of billions of dollars of subsidies, handouts, giveaways. It leads to a lot of corruption and waste. Those things really bring together people. And Washington is the last to hear from it, because I agree with you. We haven't had adequate regulation of Wall Street, and people fear it might happen again with all those speculators and conflict of interest people in Wall Street. But Washington is the last to hear about a left-right alliance bubbling up from the grassroots. So being the last to hear, they are reacting against adequate law and order, or what others call adequate regulation, to stem the corporate crime wave in America. And they underfund enforcement budgets in the Justice Department and the health and safety regulatory agencies like the Auto Safety Agency, precisely because they don't want to crack down on corporate crime. But if you rephrase it, if you ask people around the country, regardless of their political labels, do you want law and order for corporate crime the way you want it for street crime? Do you want a crackdown on all this corporate crime that the Wall Street Journal and other conservative publications are reporting on all the time? Drug companies selling you drugs that are actually creating the very disease that they're advertising it's preventing and not disclosing it. Auto companies selling you cars that are defective and they're not recalling, like the GM scandal year after year. It comes in at enormous majority.
Here's a question for you from one of our listeners via Twitter. This is from Susan. Mr. Nader, how can libertarians challenge corporatism? They're basically Republicans in disguise with glorified Ayn Randian values.
Well, those are the extreme libertarians, and they are estranged from reality. You don't see many of those, though, when you bring them down what I call the abstraction ladder. So you can get an extreme libertarian. I don't want any requirements for automobile safety. I'll take my chances. I don't want the government telling me I have to have seatbelts, airbags,
collapsible helmet,
steering columns, so it doesn't impale you in a left front collision. I don't want any of that. And then you say, well, let's put it this way. Do you want doors? Doors are required. And what if you have a children in your car? You're making a decision for the children that they're going to go through a windshield in a crash because you're against airbags and seatbelts. So you see, when you get them down to reality, that's what really solidifies the left-right alliance, because they live the same reality. When you get down to where people live, work, raise their families, they become less prone to these ethereal ideological indulgences of extreme extreme libertarians.
Very good. Let's take another break here. We'll come back and talk some more with Ralph Nader here on Midday on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, Hagerstown, WYPO, the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and Ocean City. If you have a question for Ralph Nader, always wanted to ask him this question, 410-662-8780. Or, you know, relevant to our discussion today, which is really interesting, based on Ralph Nader's new book, Unstoppable. He says it's unstoppable. The emerging left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state. Do you think that's unstoppable? Do you think such a thing could actually be achieved here in polarized America? 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We have the pleasure of the company of Ralph Nader in this hour of Midday. Earlier in the conversation, Ralph, you were talking about the minimum wage, noting that from 70 to 80% of the people support a restoration of the minimum wage to reflect the erosions of inflation. But I want to tell you what happened here in Maryland in the legislature this year. We have a blue state, Maryland, where Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1. And the Democrats are dominant in the state legislature. And they were in support of raising the minimum wage and eventually did pass one. They raised Maryland's minimum up to $10.10 an hour, over a four-year period. So by 2018, the minimum wage in Maryland will be $10.10. And I want to mention this to you. At the same time that they did this, the Democratic leadership in Annapolis proposed raising the state exemption on estate taxes from $1 million to closer to the federal limit of $5.35 million, phased in also over 4 years. So that it turned out to be kind of a trade-off. Okay, we'll give a minimum wage to the workers in the state over 4 years. We'll get you up to $10.10 an hour. But we're going to throw a little something toward the people who can, who really don't need this break, the millionaires, and we're going to raise the ceiling, the exemption on taxes from $1 million up to $5.35 million. So here we have Democrats pulling this off in this state, where they feel there needs to be this trade-off and an appeasement of some kind to the, I don't know, the job creators. I guess that's what the rationale was, although there didn't seem to be any pressing need for this, except an argument that millionaires are people, too.
Well, that's historically been the trade-off until this round, that the minimum wage managed to squeeze through in past decades only with a trade-off for business tax cuts. So basically, they would end up pretty even, Steven. I mean, they actually calculated that way. And my view is this. I don't think the taxpayer should subsidize Walmart or Target or McDonald's in what they pay their underpaid workers. The earned income tax credit for people with children has been a lot of help to poor people. But why should Walmart workers who are underpaid be placed on earned income tax credit or housing assistance or food stamps, because the bosses at Walmart, the top guy makes $11,000 an hour, 8 hours a day, by the way, out of Bentonville, Arkansas, because they don't want to pay a fair wage. Yeah. They're forcing the taxpayer to pay, to supplement the pay. And we have got to readjust our economy here to be at least as sensible as Western Europe and Canada. I mean, Canada's Ontario's minimum wage is over $10, and they're thinking of raising it, and the Canadian dollar is roughly in parity with the U.S. Australia, for people over 20 years of age, is $16 an hour, and they have a lower unemployment rate. And if you're 20, it goes down to a mere $13.50 per hour. So we're way behind the rest of the industrial world, and we're increasingly requiring taxpayers to subsidize these big corporations who deliberately underpay their workers and overpay their executives. So we need a reset to use a new word. We need to readjust the economy so that it operates on the basis of a living wage.
Let's take another call for Ralph Nader. We'll go to Baltimore County. Richard, you're on Midday. Go right ahead, please.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I'm such a huge admirer of Ralph Nader and have been for 50-plus years. It's a privilege to talk to you.
Thank you.
My quick comment and then a question. During the whole pre-Obamacare debate, I happened to read a liberal blog one week and a conservative blog another week. They both had exactly the same plan, which was essentially extending Medicare for all up to catastrophic health insurance, say over $5,000 for a year, with private insurance below that. It seemed to me an admirable compromise, and nobody talked about it at all. And I guess my main question here is, with all the tremendous amount of corporate money, how on earth can we possibly break through that and get some solutions? At one point, you argued only the super rich can save us. And how can we actually accomplish this?
Well, there is a chapter in the book called Dear Billionaire, because I think to speed up the operational impact and achievements of left-right alliances, it's going to require some citizen groups that only deal with left-right convergence. And it would be good to find an enlightened billionaire or two, and there are some around, who would start funding these nonprofit citizen advocacy groups in order to mobilize faster what is already out there in terms of a public opinion, but turning it into politically operational results in the legislature and during elections. The second thing I wanted to point out, reacting to your question, is that a lot of the real important subjects that people want politicians to talk about are off the table by the two parties. I mean, when I was running in 2008 for the presidency, to point out this, I had like 18 subject areas of long overdue changes in our country that were, for the most part, supported by a majority of the people. And I listed them. In fact, I still have the website open if you want to look at it. It's called votenator.org. And it's quite amazing. They were all off the table, the Republican candidates, and they were off the table, the Democratic candidates. And therefore, the press didn't cover it. There was no discussion. There was no polling. And people were, in effect, sidestepped on things that are of deep concern to them. Now, not far from the Maryland border, and this is an area of left-right convergence, we have to open up the ballot to more different candidates and different parties to give voters more voices and choices, rather than just the two parties. And sometime in gerrymandered districts, as you know, Dan, if we've written about, there's really only one party, the incumbent party.
Yeah.
They've carved it up in that way.
That's where we are.
Depending, you know, who controls the state government, Republican or Democrat.
That's where we are.
In the second congressional district of West Virginia, Ed Rabel, you might remember him. He was a CBS international news correspondent.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go, Ed Rabel from Saigon, you know, and very well regarded and award-winning correspondent, went back to his roots in West Virginia, where he was born. In fact, he lives right near Rabel Mountain. I mean, you know, that's how far his family goes back. A mountain is named after the family. He's running as an independent for the congressional seat, which is empty. And he's opposed, obviously, by Republican and Democrat. Well, it's extremely difficult just to get on the ballot. You have to have thousands of signatures just for a congressional district. And that shouldn't be the case. Canada, it's just a few dozen signatures, and you're on the ballot for the parliament, the federal parliament. So we need that. And in answer to the question, how do you get this going around the country? Well, how you get it going around the country is having a more fluid political process so that the sentiments of the people have an opening and they're not blocked by one or two of the major parties.
Well, this is primary election day in Maryland, Ralph Nader, and Democrats get to vote for Democrats and Republicans get to vote for Republicans. And if you're anything else, you don't actually get to vote today. Holly, one of our listeners, has a question along these lines for you. So, Holly, you're on with Ralph Nader. Go right ahead, please.
Hi, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Nader, for your courage and your perseverance. I wondered if you could talk at all about why our voter turnout in this country is so low. And one more question is, do you have any thoughts on our governor's race in Maryland?
We're experiencing very low turnout today for this primary. It was looking pretty grim up until about noon today. And that's not unusual. This happens other places, too.
Well, you know, this is an increasing crisis. Now, not only are there voter suppression efforts in some states making it more difficult to vote, which fortunately the courts are overturning in a lot of states, but people are withdrawing voluntarily from voting. Like, pox on both your houses. And so you see, there are two easy ways to go through life, Dan. One is to believe everything, and the other is to believe nothing. And both avoid thinking. And the very idea, never mind what our forebears fought for to give us the right to vote and so on, just from our own self-respect, we should say we're going to go and vote. And if we don't like the candidates, we're going to just write in our choice. Just write it in. And maybe someday we'll have a binding none of the above on every ballot line for mayor, for city council, governor, president. And if the none of the above wins, they have to have a new election with new candidates. And that will bring out people who don't have confidence in the existing electoral system, but they have an opportunity to say no. You can't vote no in America today. If you go vote, you got to vote yes for someone. And you got to give people a no confidence vote. On the current gubernatorial, I know very little about what's going on. I just know Governor O'Malley, and I had a conversation with him 3 months ago, and he indicated he was going to challenge Hillary Clinton for the presidential nomination. He's going to run for president. Well, the country does need someone to challenge what seems to be a coronation now for Hillary Clinton. I mean, you couldn't have a duller Democratic presidential primary if you don't have vibrant challengers such as Senator Bernie Sanders or Governor O'Malley.
I just want to add a little bit to your statement about believe everything and believe nothing. My favorite quote comes from, I think it's Alexander Cockburn or his father, one of the Cockburns: believe nothing until it has been officially denied.
That's well put.
Yeah, I thought you'd like that one.
Yeah, it's Alexander Cockburn. That's the way it's
Cockburn,
pronounced.
Cockburn.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's not. I knew that once upon a time. Linda in Baltimore has a question for Ralph Nader on consumerism. Go right ahead, Linda.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm in a situation now, but I know that my situation is a microcosm of a bigger issue. I recently paid $400 for something that I did not get from a local business. The local business is blaming the international company from which it came, and neither will take responsibility for it. I still have nothing, and I have called the international executive offices. They will not take my call. I feel very frustrated. Somebody has my money, and I have nothing. And I know that there's consumer protection, but what does one do when I feel as if corporate and business now are excluding the little average consumer? Thank you.
Well, as long as you have good records, ma'am, you can, here are your options. Last I heard, there was a good consumer protection unit in the Maryland Attorney General office in Annapolis, and there might be an existing consumer protection unit in the government, state government. So look it up and send your complaint there. If you want to get faster action, learn how, if you haven't already, to use small claims court. Baltimore has a small claims court. You don't need a lawyer. It's extremely simple. You go there, the clerk tells you, you fill out this short form, and then you present your case. And a lot of times, the companies you're complaining against won't show up. And if they don't show up, you win automatically under a default judgment. And if you have a strong case where you actually have sent a check for $400 and gotten nothing, you're going to win. And if you're going to win, you're going to win with a court judgment. Now, I assume that this company is not so fly-by-night that it has no assets. But that's one way to get their attention, so they try to settle it right away.
Linda, you just got some consumer advice from Ralph Nader. I don't think there's any better advice around. You can also check in Baltimore, the Better Business Bureau, and the Consumer Protection Division of the Attorney General's Office in Baltimore for the state of Maryland. So we hope that helps. Lance, in Baltimore, your question for Ralph Nader, please.
Yes, thanks, Dan, Mr. Nader. I'm a big fan of Noam Chomsky, and he has a lecture out where he titles it How Law is Destroying America. And under it, he depicts the Supreme Court. Ultimately, when there's an issue of holding corporate America accountable or an issue where it's closing the economic gap between the rich and the middle class or poor in this country, and it ends up in the Supreme Court, you have to ask yourself a question. Is this Supreme Court Democratic, Republican, independent, or corporate? You know, so can you respond to that, please? Thank you.
I think the Supreme Court majority now is behaving very badly in subordinating the sovereignty of the people to the sovereignty of corporations. The recent cases, the McCutcheon case and the Citizens United case, basically open season, corporations can spend whatever they want to oppose or support a candidate at the local, state, and national level in the USA. And if you take the Supreme Court majority, the Roberts Court, with Scalia and Alito and Thomas and others, if you take their cases over the last 15 years or so, and before Roberts came on, what's happened is a pattern of subordinating people to corporations. They have not only expanded the concept of corporate personhood, you know, giving artificial entities that have no soul, they have no morality. We're not talking about employees of companies. The corporate entity should never be given superiority over real human beings. The Constitution starts we the people. It doesn't start we the corporation. The word corporation or company or political party doesn't even exist in our Constitution. So the question is, why are we ruled by them? And that's because the courts have bent in their direction again and again. Now, there are ways around this, you know, until you wait for a different kind of majority. If it flips with different nominees replacing retirement of existing Supreme Court justices, there are a lot of things that can be done that they cannot overturn on constitutional grounds.
Ralph Nader.
Unfortunately, election rules are not among them.
Ralph, we're going to have to end there on this election day. We appreciate having you on our show today and appreciate what you're saying and putting forth in this book, Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Got to dig into this some more. Ralph, thank you very much. It was great to have you on the show. Thanks for the words.
Thank you very much, Dan. There's a lot more to discuss, and it's up to you, folks.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in for our show today on this election day. We'll see you again soon.
Midday Senior Producer is Nikki Gamer. The Producer and Director is Jonathan Ahrens. The Associate Producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.